The Arc 1015 have arrived. We'll call the House Tax Committee to order.
Do you have a quorum?
Quorum is not present, so we'll officially call the meeting to order as soon as we do have a quorum. So today we're fortunate to have some very fine folks with us to put their testimony on the record. And again, we're not debating the federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. What I want to see is how does it affect your group, and how can we help your organizations as best we can, if we can. So with that, I will start. We're very fortunate today to have with us Ms. Nan Madden, Minnesota Budget Project Director, and also representing today the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. Is that correct, Ms. Madden? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nan Madden. I'm Director of the Minnesota Budget Project. And we are part of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, but Taylor, my colleague from the council, will also have some testimony for you.
Wonderful. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate you getting off to a quick start at looking at this federal tax bill. It certainly creates a complex situation for state tax policy, and we appreciate the remarks you have made, Mr. Chair, about the importance of taking the time to fully understand its implications and effects. It's hard to catch up with fast-moving legislation that moves so late in the year. We believe that the state's response to the federal tax bill should be grounded in Minnesota values, including treating all taxpayers fairly, especially keeping in mind our low and moderate income taxpayers, as well as the importance of fiscal responsibility and maintaining the revenues needed to sustainably fund the state's priorities. And I'm going to point to a few of our major concerns regarding conformity, first of which is that the preliminary analysis suggests that conforming to the major individual income tax changes would increase taxes on many low- and middle-income families with children, and that family size would become less of a factor in determining a family's Minnesota taxes than it is today. The elimination of the personal and dependent exemptions is the conformity provision with the largest impact on Minnesota families. For many families with dependents, the higher standard deduction is not enough to offset the lost value of personal and dependent exemptions. So that results in higher taxable income and likely a state tax increase. That impact gets bigger with each additional dependent. So if you choose to conform to the federal law's changes in the standard deduction and exemptions, we ask you to pair that with a targeted response to avoid tax increases on low- and middle-income families with dependents. A second concern is that the elimination of the federal dependent exemption could create an $84 million cut in property tax refunds to seniors, people with disabilities, and families with dependents. And that's because our property tax refund, also called the circuit breaker or renter's credit, provides an adjustment for seniors, people with disabilities, and family dependents by referencing the value of federal personal and dependent exemptions, with which the new law sets at zero. So recreating the value of those exemptions in our state property tax refund, we think should be a priority, so we don't have this unintended consequence of a cut in property tax refunds for seniors, people with disabilities, and dependents. And finally, we believe this is a time of considerable uncertainty about the future funding relationship between the states and the federal government. Large cuts in federal funding to the states have been given serious consideration in Congress. So in that context, we think it is important to maintain state revenues so Minnesota can sustainably fund our schools, our nursing homes, public safety, economic development, the whole range of critical services that are provided at the state and local levels. We don't think Minnesota can afford to enact large additional state tax cuts for those who get the largest federal tax cuts. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today about the importance of prioritizing fiscal responsibility and treating taxpayers fairly. I look forward to continuing to work with you on these issues this session.
Thank you, Ms. Madden. We do have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. I think what we'll do is we will go with questions as people testify, and I'll kind of manage the clock because we also have today member questions for nonpartisan staff, and I know there are many. So with that, Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifier, you brought up the issue of the dependent deductions. Do you have suggestions on the
best way that we could address that? Would it just be a lowering of the 5.35 rate, or what options do you think we should consider?
Ms. Madden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that question. I think lowering the rates is not particularly targeted. It feels like it seems like some of the main ways you could go would be creating a state personal exemption. I know there's others looking at creating a state-level child tax credit and some decisions around there. You know, we've been looking into that, but we need to, I think, see some more modeling and dig into how those actually would work.
Chair Garofalo.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Madden. We will now go on to Taylor, I want to say this right, Putz. Okay, Taylor Putz, public policy advocate, Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please. I don't know why I say it because I just did it. But I think you have to do it for the record. But before we do that, actually, Representative Schultz moves the minutes of February 22nd, 2018. Any discussion? Hearing none, all fair say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Okay, please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Davids and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Taylor Putz, and I am the public policy advocate at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, representing 2,100 of the state's nonprofit organizations.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to follow up on the House Research Department's report from last week about the unintended consequences on charitable giving. As you heard, the federal tax plan preserved the charitable deduction for itemizers. However, the number of Minnesotans who benefit from this tax incentive will decrease by 64%. Fewer people itemizing means fewer people will have a tax incentive to give to charities and religious organizations. These organizations rely on charitable giving to meet local needs such as providing after-school programs, healthy food, art, and affordable housing. Similar to how we've heard of people prepaying their property taxes, we've heard from organizations that donors have also pre-donated last December for future years. This demonstrates that people give because they care, and they give more because of the tax incentive. The Minnesota legislature can address this unintended consequence of the federal tax plan by preserving and strengthening the state's charitable deduction for non-itemizers. Currently, only 50% of donations over $500 are counted towards the deduction. The charitable deduction is an important part of our state's tax code. I look forward to talking with you in the future about ways we can continue the state's strong tradition of charitable giving. Chairman Davids and members of the committee, thank you again for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Putz. And you hit on an area that's near and dear to my heart that I really hope we can do some things, kind of what we talked yesterday. And,
right.
And this one... this one hits home for a lot of people, so hopefully we can make some progress on this. So, questions for Mr. Putz? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Keith Carlson, Executive Director, Minnesota Intercounty Association. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of four of the suburban counties and 10 Greater Minnesota regional counties. I want to start off today by acknowledging the challenges that you're going to be facing with conformity. You're going to be facing choices between simplicity and minimizing tax increases on Minnesotans, aligning or not aligning with the filing levels for the federal income tax, and importantly, managing the revenue impacts of this potential change. With regards to the revenue impacts, we do want to express a concern that one-time revenues are not used to be cushion what may be the ongoing cost of any conformity package that you come up with. One of the choices that you'll have to make is how to treat the state and local tax deduction that is limited to $10,000 for itemizers under the federal tax bill. To some extent, that choice will be dictated by the broader goals that I just went through. And we understand that. However, to the extent it's not contrary to your broader goals or objectives, we do want to make a plea that you minimize the impact, particularly for those who already lose under federal tax reform. I provided the committee with a document that reads background information on state and local tax deduction. And the first three pages of those documents sort of identifies by income class the average itemized deduction for state and local taxes and separately for property taxes in three counties that sort of represent the central Center City counties of Hennepin, the suburban counties, Dakota County, and a greater Minnesota county of St. Louis, so you can get some idea of what's are being claimed right now. These are from the Statistics of Income for 2015, the latest county-by-county data available. On the last two pages, then, I show, again, by income classes for statewide, an estimate of who the winners and losers are under federal tax reform, with obviously the cap on the itemized deductions being a major factor in that. It's worth noting that the highest proportion of losers under the federal reform are in the $124,000 to $255,000 bracket. There are also those who have historically claimed higher itemized deductions for property taxes. Those same property taxes have historically been claimed on the state return of these individuals. The itemized deduction for local taxes, although in some instances small, is effectively part of the state's property tax relief system. For itemizers, it pays anywhere from 5.35% to 9.85% of their property taxes through reduced state income taxes. The subsidy is, in fact, higher for certain taxpayers subject to itemized deductions or personal exemption phase-outs under current law. I should note the state pays substantially more of the property taxes of middle and lower income homeowners through the property tax refund, anywhere from 50% to 85% when their property taxes exceed from 1% to 2.5% of their income. About 470,000 of the state's 1.3 million homeowners do take advantage of that program. Our two final requests if you do elect to conform to the federal $10,000 limitation on the state and local tax deductions, that you do not penalize those who continue to itemize and fail to maximize their deduction on the state return by carelessly or naively electing to claim their state income tax as the itemized deductions on their federal return, where either or both the state income tax or the property taxes can be claimed. On the state return currently, only property taxes may be claimed. The state income tax deduction claimed on the federal return must be added back on the state return up to the point where the taxpayer's total itemized deductions equal no more than the current standard deduction. A taxpayer who unwittingly files his or her federal return with first claiming the state income tax would in effect be penalized then when they turn around and file their federal return if you maintain the add back as it is right now. They should be allowed the option of claiming the property tax on their state return despite the manner in which they chose to file federally. Second thing I'd like to mention is to reinforce what Ms. Madden said. I encourage you not to eliminate the exclusion or the exemption for dependents or for the elderly on the property tax refund for the reasons that Ms. Madden stated. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions for Mr. Carlson. Chair Groffalo.
Thank you. So, again, the same question for the testifier. With regards to the $10,000 cap, you accurately pointed out the pitfalls with it. With the exception of being able to write off your maintaining the ability to write off your property taxes on your state and your state return, is there any specific suggestions you have for us to address this?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I did sort of identify at the beginning the difficulties that you're going to face. It's, again, a one of simplicity, basically adopting the federal as-is or making the return more complicated and, as you, I think, are inferring, allowing all property taxes to be deducted regardless of whether it goes beyond that $10,000 cap or not. It has revenue implications in doing that, and certainly we welcome its retention in that, but we do have to be cognizant of those revenue impacts and also the impacts on the simplicity of filing the state return.
Chair Groffalo. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Carlson. And I don't know if you can answer this question or not, but obviously we have people filing their taxes now, okay, and if we pass conformity, do they have to amend their tax return, or should they wait to conformity to see what we pass? I mean, we're kind of in limbo in a number of different areas.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruenhagen, most of the federal changes do not take effect until the tax year 2018, the return that will be filed in 2019. So there are relatively few instances where an amended return would be required under any conformity you would elect to do. So it's largely a moot issue, but I'll acknowledge there may be limited instances where that problem exists.
And there are several moving, well, a lot of moving pieces here, but one, this is the bill that we're discussing or how to conform with is for 2018. But there could be some extenders for 2017 yet that could create a situation that Representative Gruenhagen refers to. So any other questions for Mr. Carlson? Thank you, Mr. Carlson, as always. Mr. Ethan Roberts, Director of Government Affairs, Jewish Community Relations Council. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, Chair Davis. I feel most welcome. My name is Ethan Roberts. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas. I'm here today representing both my organization as well as the two organizations which fund my program, the Minneapolis Jewish Federation and the St. Paul Jewish Federation, which act many ways like the United Way for our Jewish community. And never had a song before while testifying. Kind of makes it more interesting, doesn't it?
It's the Russians.
Yeah, exactly. It's the Russians. They're everywhere. Everywhere, ruining everything. So I represent those organizations as well as the many nonprofits, such as Jewish Family and Children's Service in Minneapolis, which provide basic social services for people in the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community. Now, there's a saying which I'm sure will resonate with both members of both parties on this committee, which is, everything that needs to be said has already been said, but not everyone's had a chance to say it. Well, I don't want to be that person. My organization, the organizations I just mentioned, are all members of the Council of Nonprofits. Tara Putz did a beautiful job, I think, laying out the case for the nine-itemizer deduction for charitable giving. Really much appreciate the visit we had yesterday with Chair Davids and your comments, and so I don't want to belabor any more time at the committee, and I'll just kind of concur with what Mr. Putz said, and if you have any questions you didn't have for him, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll be on my way and let you continue down the list.
And thank you, Mr. Roberts, for your time yesterday also. Questions for Mr. Roberts? Okay, thank you very much, sir. David Sensman, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Davis Sensman, and I am an advisory board member of the Main Street Alliance of Minnesota and also the founder of Davis Law Office.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. As a member of Main Street Alliance of Minnesota's advisory board and a small business attorney with a roster of over 800 Minnesota-based small business clients, I read and analyzed the federal tax bill so that I could help explain it to my colleagues and clients. I've also written and contributed to a number of published pieces explaining how the changes to the tax code will affect small business owners. So I'm here today with two requests on behalf of those folks. The first is that as you work on tax conformity and decide how to change the Minnesota tax laws in response to the federal law changes, that you not make the same mistake your counterparts in Washington made and that you actually reach out and engage those of us in those communities to hear honestly how any proposed change might affect those communities. Please don't limit the information you receive to simply that provided by groups who can pay enough to have a lobbyist here, as I assure you that none of those folks speak for the actual small businesses of Minnesota. The second is that you realize that in thinking about what's best for small businesses of Minnesota, a group that at last report by the SBA employed 47.9% of Minnesota employees, you realize that for the vast majority of those businesses, which some estimates put as high as 95%, their business from a tax standpoint doesn't exist. That's what a pass-through entity is. It's disregarded for tax purposes. These taxpayers pay tax on all of their income at the personal level, and in Minnesota, the median income for those individuals who owned pass-through businesses in 2015, which is the last year for which data is available, from the Small Business Administration was $48,241. And that's their income from all sources. Folks who make $48,241 are generally one catastrophe away from needing any of the social services that Minnesota has historically been able to provide and which are funded by the tax base. Folks who make $48,241 are not worried about whether the estate tax exemption in Minnesota will be raised from $3 million, but are worried about whether there will be enough money to fund Minnesota Care or heating assistance if their business suffers a down month. Folks who make $48,241 a year are counting on you to realize that the highest income residents in Minnesota got a gift from the federal government in many ways, including the complicated 20% pass-through deduction, and they certainly don't need a matching one from this legislature, especially considering that particular federal change is projected to cost our state $592 million in revenue. Small business owners are more interested in funding for health care, child care, education, and infrastructure than they are with additional tax cuts. If you want to know what would help these small businesses, I invite you to ask them and not to listen to those folks who will tell you what's best for them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the witness? Chair Groffel.
Thank you. And to the testifier, should we surmise from your testimony then that when we conform and raise revenue, we should give none of that? We should not make that revenue neutral. We should not lower rates, provide additional credits. We should just keep it available for resources.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying you should think about it in a personal way, not think about it in giving additional corporate tax cuts, because most small business owners aren't, for purposes of tax purposes, corporations.
Chair Groffel.
Mr. Chairman, to the testifier, can you give us an example of some of those policies that you, that your organization or you personally would like to, revenue reductions that you would support?
The witness.
Revenue reductions that we would support?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Groffel. Testifier, what's happening is that if we conform, we're raising revenue. And so the mindset here of the committee and on a bipartisan basis is that we want to have revenue reductions so that taxpayers as a whole are kept neutral or possibly having some sort of tax relief that nets out a tax relief. So with conforming, we're raising a bunch of revenue. So I think I don't want to speak to the other side of the aisle, but I think there's bipartisan consensus that we need to reduce revenue to make it fair to taxpayers. Do you have an example of some of those revenue reductions that you would be supportive of, either your organization or you personally?
Well, we would be supportive of revenue reductions that are aimed at the lowest taxpayers, which often includes small business owners. There's no need to provide any additional relief to those folks who have received the biggest portion, which are overwhelmingly corporations and folks making higher income.
Mr. Chairman, to the testifier, can you give us an example of some of those policies that, was it lowering the 5.35 rate, would that be something that meets that category, or do you have other examples of things that would be that we can look to support?
The testifier.
Well, we would support many of the things that the folks who had previously testified, maintaining the non-itemized deduction for nonprofits, anything that will help, that will not just be a one-time windfall to those who are making higher amounts, but things that will be, that will look to the future and will look to not take additional revenues and use them to provide additional tax cuts to people who are already receiving a federal tax cut.
Chair Groffel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifier, I get the point of what you're against. You've said it about 7 times now, and I understand that you've made that point eloquent. What I'm wondering is, when it comes to the revenue reductions, are there specific policies? So, for example, is taking the 5.35 income tax rate and lowering that?
Sure.
Is that something that your organization,
sure,
or your person? Okay. Thank you.
Testifier?
Yes.
Okay. Chair
Thank
Groffel.
You. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sensenman, for coming here. And I heard you say that the median income for the small businesses that you attract was $48,241, and I think it shows how, I mean, they do get business deductions, depreciation, those sorts of things, but how our small businesses really are fragile, and we have in this tax committee at times debated their disadvantage in competing with some of the online businesses and dealt with some of the sales tax issues that impact them. And so, you know, I think that there is some bipartisan interest in making sure that our small Main Street businesses, and like that name, survive. Can you tell me, in terms of your organization, how are you defining a small business? Because I know in statute we have different definitions and numbers of employees and that sort of thing. It'd be helpful to know.
So that statistic is the Small Business Associate, the SBA, the Federal SBA's definition. So it actually encompasses, I mean, that's a median, so you have half below and half above. But that encompasses, and that's a 2015 number, so it's a little dated, but it encompasses small businesses under the definition from the SBA, which goes up to 100 employees. We don't necessarily define that as small business, but there's no research for businesses that are smaller. It's hard to come by. So that number is actually from the SBA.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sherman, and thank you. I think that's helpful, and I think, you know, this is a major sector of our employment section, and we really need to understand what that's going to mean for the employees and the viability of these businesses as we move forward. So I appreciate your speaking up because we don't always hear your voice.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, you know, I think the challenge for the committee is to do no harm. And I just would like to point out to you that with regard to the lowest tier, if all of the effort or energy is given to that, there's about $12.2 billion of individual income tax revenue. The lowest tier is about represents about 25% of that. So there's 75% of taxpayers under the proposal that, you seem to suggest you would support. I don't think that that is doing no harm to the rest of the ratepayers in Minnesota. So I think that's the real challenge. We have to really figure out the complexities of what conformity is going to mean and who's going to get pinched by this and try to tailor the Minnesota tax code to do no harm. And if we can have a no net increase, and allow the relief that's going to taxpayers across our great nation to be incurred at the federal level, that's great. But there's real opportunity here to do something. So I just wanted to add a little bit about the numbers. That's the number that we collect, and that's a projected number under the conformity law 2018. And that lowest tier is a smaller portion of what is getting paid into the system. Thank you.
Thank you, President Pertus. Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Mr. Michaels. The way I think of the Minnesota income tax rates, my terminology would be stacked, that that my income up to a certain threshold, I pay at the 5.3% rate. Income above that, I pay at the next rate. Income above that threshold, I pay at the higher rate, and I never had to worry about the top rate. So that a reduction in the lowest income tax rate would actually benefit all income taxpayers. Am I correct in that understanding, Mr. Michaels?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, excuse me, Representative Dabney, that's correct. If you cut the bottom bracket, the people in the higher brackets also benefit because some of their income is taxed, as you indicated, in that lower bracket.
Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. And I guess I wish that the GOP on the federal level had taken a do-no-harm approach to this tax bill, because we already are seeing the threats to Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, with the argument being, well, we don't have the revenue to support those programs, when those programs are critical to small business owners, as the attorney here before us has indicated, and to so many others in the country. I wish a do-no-harm approach had been taken on the federal level. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Any other questions for the witness, for the testifier? Okay, thank you very
much.
Thank you very much. We will now go to, we have Bob Tracy on the list, and you'll see in your packet, members, a letter to myself and Chair Marquardt with some testimony. Mr. Tracy was not able to make the committee today, so please take a look at his letter if you would, please. The next person is Brad Leto, Legislative Director, Minnesota AFL-CIO. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brad Leto. I'm the Legislative Director and Chief of Staff for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And per your instruction, Mr. Chair, I only mentioned the federal tax bill in relation to possible conformity by the state of Minnesota. As has already been stated by the Department of Revenue and other testifiers, Minnesota conformity to the federal tax bill must be done carefully and deliberately. I realize all legislators want a very brief 2018 legislative session. However, the Minnesota AFL-CIO would urge the tax committee to analyze very carefully provisions of the federal tax bill with which to conform. especially as Congress may consider further corrections to fix issues in the Tax Act, and in fact, daily I seem to find new provisions come to light. I must say I am encouraged that this committee appears to be moving carefully. Perhaps if Congress had been more deliberative and had some public hearings, we would not be in the situation we are in. The Minnesota AFL-CIO stands ready to assist the committee in this conformity discussion, and we will be weighing in throughout this session. We would, however, offer a few basic measures to consider when looking at conformity. First and foremost, any type of conformity should not increase taxes of lower and middle income working people, and you've already heard some of that testimony. The potential tax increase via conformity on working families with several dependents is certainly unacceptable. Second, we would encourage the immediate repayment of taxes for corporations returning to the state after leaving the state to avoid taxes, the repatriation tax. We should not wait 8 years in the state of Minnesota to get taxes for which some corporations who left the state in the first place, especially as the corporations that remain paid their taxes.
Just wait a second, to that point there, we're not talking about the corporations that left the country, but we're talking about money the corporations that are in the country have overseas. Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the repatriation tax does relate to what are typically called deferred foreign earnings. And so, yes, I think it's fair to characterize that as the earnings of the controlled foreign corporations, typically of domestic multinationals that Congress is now requiring, before going to a territorial system, that tax be paid on that income.
Absolutely, but I think that any of the deferred income should be paid immediately rather than over 8 years is what I would say. I think with the money paid back immediately by corporations via that tax, I would encourage you to use this for a progressive purpose. And I offer just one example. There could be many. But filling part of the gap left in Minnesota care due to the President Trump's administration promising funds and then pulling them back would be a noble place to commit those tax proceeds, we believe. Third, we should always consider the budget as a whole when considering federal tax conformity. We look forward to the forecast tomorrow and the governor's potential, if there is a surplus, supplemental budget to follow. Investments in people and their families is as important as tax breaks for CEOs and corporations, I believe. So again, Mr. Chair and committee members, the Minnesota AFL-CIO would encourage an open and fair public deliberative process, and we are indeed encouraged that the committee is doing exactly that, and we stand ready to work with the administration and legislature on conformity legislation. And we will be talking about specific provisions as we go along through the tax hearing. And I just want to mention, I know that the, I think the trades are going to talk about one provision that we found afterwards. I also did find another provision on a tax credit for 2 weeks to corporations or businesses for 2 weeks of paid family leave, which is a 12% credit if you provide 50% of the wages, and more than that if you provide more of the income. We would say that 2 weeks of a tax credit to businesses is not going to help many people, but that's just an aside. So I'm just, the point is, daily I seem to find new things in the tax bill. So I'm an expert on this yet? Absolutely not.
Thank you very much. And to everyone that's testified and everyone that's going to testify, please be assured that my door is open to every one of you at any time. Well, not any time. We're booked for this, right?
And almost
next week. So it'd be, we'll make it work. We'll figure it out. We'll get together. And also, just to make sure that members know, when the governor comes out with his supplemental bill, I'll be carrying that, and we will have full hearings and give the administration as much time and the department as much time as they need to look at those things, those issues. So any questions for Mr. Leto? Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Leto. I heard you talk about a progressive agenda, Mr. Leto. So are you favoring giving disproportionate tax cuts to people who don't pay taxes?
Mr. Leto?
In other words, are you looking at giving people more benefit out of this than they actually paid in?
Mr. Leto?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drzkowski, when I said a progressive provision would be to take the taxes that corporations have deferred on their income and do that, put that into one pot rather than just, you know, disperse it, and maybe that one noble purpose would be the fill some of the hole in Minnesota care. That's where I referenced the progressive nature.
Chair Drzkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Mr. Leto, you're suggesting taking from one taxpayer the taxes that they paid and instead providing a benefit to people who may not have paid any taxes. That's what I'm hearing.
Mr. Leto?
As you know, Minnesota Care is provided for working Minnesotans that pay on a sliding fee scale. And so I would say that working Minnesotans, they're on Minnesota Care, including a lot of rural farmers, I would think that that is not necessarily something that they haven't deserved. And I would just remind everybody that the Minnesota Care program started with a Republican governor and a DFL legislature.
Chair Drzkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Leto, you've talked a lot about the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, Insure and so forth, but I know that your organization, AFL-CIO, has been exempt from the Cadillac tax. Based upon your comments here today, do you think that your organization should be required to be part of the Cadillac tax on your health care plan?
Mr. Leto?
First, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I talked about Minnesota Care, not Minsure. I first of all would say that the quote unquote Cadillac tax is a very disrespectful term, and it is a term used not by us, the so-called Cadillac tax. It is people that provide very good health care for folks, unlike other folks, elected officials, I'm not saying here, anywhere else that provide very good health care. Should the unions be exempt from that tax? Yes, I believe so. Should they be taxed as other people are on that? Sure. But should they be extra? And I every time they do tax reform, they don't want to touch, they don't want to deal with that tax. And so that makes me skeptical.
Chair Anderson. Okay. Thank you so much. And again, you know where my office is.
Absolutely.
And we will have further discussions. Thank you very much for your testimony. Chris Conroy, Take Action Minnesota. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you. Chairman Davids, members of the committee, my name is Chris Conroy. I'm with Take Action Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today, and thank you in advance for your work this year. This will be a complex bill with far-reaching impacts. I respect the hours and thought and care that everyone here will put into making this bill work for Minnesota. Though it's complex, our top priorities remain fairly simple. We want a tax system that is both adequate and progressive. It's no secret that the federal law doesn't meet either of those goals. However, the opportunity for us as a state is to take a step back and ask what will work for us here. What positions us well for the future? What sets us up to take care of one another? To make the state more equitable and to build on our strengths? Every reduction in revenue is a choice that should be considered compared next to the very real needs that Minnesotans are experiencing every day in every corner of the state. There is one particular area of conformity that I want to lift up as a case in point. The federal bill has changed the treatment of foreign-sourced income in a dramatic way by shifting to a kind of partial territorial system. This change, about 30 years of income that has not re-entered the U.S. is being deemed repatriated, then taxed at a lower rate, repayable over an 8-year backloaded schedule. In other words, this is one-time money. Going forward, foreign source dividends will be 100% deductible from a business's federal taxable income. So if you conform to these provisions, please consider protecting these funds. As a state, we should commit these funds to a one-time investment in a shared public purpose, to build child savings accounts for every kid in Minnesota, to set up a paid family leave system, to close disparity gaps in STEM education. There's a number of worthy investments you could make, or the legislature could make. This is an opportunity we should not let pass us by. A second recommendation to mitigate these potential base erosion issues, the federal law includes a new GILTI and FDII provisions. How these provisions will work, what their limits are really untested. The IRS has not yet issued guidance on them. They have not been enforced or litigated. There will likely be years of testing what the law permits and doesn't. In a period of uncertainty like this, we'd recommend that you equip the department with the tools it needs to be able to evaluate the cases it gets and to enforce our law. The economic substance test is one tool that would be very helpful in managing our state's response to this profoundly changed system, and I would ask that you please consider including it. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Connery. Questions for Mr. Connery? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Tom Peterson. From our friends at Minnesota Farmers Union. Please state your name for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union and appreciate the opportunity to offer some brief comments on the federal tax conformity. We're still working through it like a lot of groups. There's a lot of good and a lot of different things in the tax bill for farmers and encouraging, but I wanted to share the things that we're hearing right now from our members that you might consider in the upcoming weeks. We've talked a lot about the Section 179 for years in this committee. Now the federal bill goes from $500,000 to $1 million for Section 179 for rapid depreciation. In Minnesota, as you're all familiar, is at $25,000. We hear a lot about that from farmers when they're buying a piece of equipment. As equipment, and it's been that, I don't know exactly, I saw 2002, but it's been that way for a long time. It is equipment increases in value and price that farmers are buying. We really encourage you. I know full conformity would cost a lot of money, but maybe consider raising it to something, whether it's 50 or 100,000, would be helpful to farmers. My understanding is, though, in talking to some of farm accountants, one piece that I really want to highlight is my understanding in the new federal tax law is that personal property tax changes will require the farm to report the taxable gain on the sale of machinery when you're trading it in. You're going to have to report that as income. And so that will be when a farmer goes to trade a piece of equipment, it is going to be an issue. They can offset that at the federal level by using either 100% bonus depreciation or the Section 179. In Minnesota, as you're familiar, our bonus depreciation is 20%. Our Section 179, again, is $25,000. My understanding is raising the Section 179 would take care of that issue and talking to some accountants. Still working through that issue, but I really feel that farmers are, unfortunately, with income being down right now, but people will be buying and trading equipment, and I think that's something that you're going to hear about. So I encourage you to look at that issue. I'd also say that we're also working through another issue that came up here as a co-op provision. It's a 1099A that you may have heard about that gives an advantage for farmers to sell to a co-op. That hopefully will be addressed at a federal level soon, but it may not be. So that's another issue that the committee may want to continue to look at. So I urge your consideration as we go forward, and we're willing to work on these issues. Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, one thing, and thank you for your testimony. I think one big provision that's being kind of overlooked is usually Section 179 or bonus were for new equipment. Now they've included used equipment.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like a big deal.
Yes.
So that hopefully that'll help a lot of folks. Okay, sure. Questions for Mr. Peterson? Thank you very much. Jason George. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Jason George with the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 49.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir. I'm going to be very brief because I'm not a tax policy expert and I want to stay out of trouble.
Never stop me.
that didn't work, huh? Okay.
Yeah.
We have one very specific issue that I just want to highlight, an issue that I'm getting a number of calls from members about. And this is not a union issue or a non-union issue. This is a construction worker issue, blue-collar worker issue. It's the elimination of the unreimbursed travel expense for work-related issues, work-related expenses, the elimination of that deduction on the federal level. Our members are going to do their taxes this year right now, and they're being told by their tax preparers that, and some of these folks have $20,000, $30,000 worth of unreimbursed expenses out of their pocket when they go work somewhere in Minnesota or around the country that they have to pay for their hotel room or how to get there, all travel expenses, et cetera. The standard deduction is not quite going to do it for them, and they're being told by their tax preparers they're going to get a massive tax increase next year. So I know that there's not anything that you all can do about that at the federal level. It's probably more of a federal issue, but we do have a state income tax, and any break or any way we could fix that at the local level here in the state would be beneficial to those men and women. So I just wanted to put that on your radar. I'm not an expert, as I indicated before, but I look forward to working with you and talking more about it and looking for ways we can fix that.
Thank you, Mr. George. We have a very interesting point here. Mr. Michael, okay, so I'm a self-employed business person. I have to travel someplace. I have meals, hotel room. That I can deduct those. That hasn't changed. What the gentleman's talking about is you are employed by somebody and you need to travel to get to that employment, and now you can't deduct it. Is that what we're talking about here?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. For an employee, you are allowed under prior federal law to claim a miscellaneous itemized deduction for unreimbursed employee business expenses. And Congress, in its wisdom, decided that that was something that was not necessary and repealed that as one of the itemized deductions that's allowable. And, of course, we're using that in part to fund the increase in the standard deduction.
And I'm still okay, right?
Mr. Chairman, since you're, I believe, yes, since you're a proprietor or a pass-through entity, those business expenses are deducted on Schedule C, and those are still allowed. It's the employees,
okay,
which many of these employees. They're not independent contractors.
What if they became an independent contractor?
Mr. Chairman, yes, if they became independent contractors, they would then qualify to take it on Schedule C, but understand that that means they then lose the protections that go with being an employee. Suddenly they have to pay the full ride on the Social Security tax. There's no workers' comp.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But couldn't they create an S corporation and then take those expenses as an employee as well?
We're going to figure this out, Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schultz, yes, they could create an S-Corp and do that, but then they would be their own employer and they would be responsible for all of those other things, and they, in effect, would be an independent contractor. So they would have, if they want workers' comp insurance, they would have to buy that. If they're going to be covered by unemployment in comp, they would be paying the FUTA tax and all of that sort of thing.
Representative Schultz?
But they could be an employee of an organization and have an S corporation. Is that not true?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schultz, yes. If they form an S corporation, the S corporation rules require them to pay their employees reasonable compensation, whatever that means. It's obviously up, you know, but it doesn't change the dynamic that the business that they're actually working for and is paying them. Somehow, the payments to them, metamorphizing from being an employee of the larger business that's employing the union workers to becoming somehow an independent contractor, whether that's in the guise of an S-Corp or a partnership, LLC, or just as an individual, that suddenly the responsibility for the Social Security tax, the unemployment and all of that thing becomes the obligation of that entity that they've created, which is a fundamental change in the relationship that's involved.
Representative Detmer, Chairman Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, if I was a construction worker and the company I'm working for takes me many miles away from my home, but they provide the transportation and also provide the housing for me, will I be taxed on that that benefit?
Mr. Michael? I think I figured a way around this. Oh, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Detmer, the new federal legislation changes the dynamics of this somewhat. The employee that gets, where the employer reimburses those expenses, the employee's not taxed on those, but the employer will lose the deduction for those meals and entertainment expenses. And so it's sort of like under the old scheme, they were 50% for meals, they were 50% and entertainment, they were 50% deductible. And in travel status, they still will be deductible. But if they're not in travel status, then it's no longer deductible. So it's sort of a complicated answer to that.
So, Mr. Mike, my theory, I thought instead of having the employee pay, I'd have the employer pay, but they're under the same rules as the employee.
Some of the deduction for the businesses were disallowed, and some of them were not. And it's a little more. It basically depends upon whether they're in what the IRS considers to be travel status or not, whether it's deductible, still deductible. So
you're wrong. Blew all sorts of holes in that one. Okay, Chair Depp.
I'm fine.
Other questions for Mr. George? Mr. George, thank you for bringing this to our attention, and we will talk further on it. Mark?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Haveman. Mark Haveman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and your representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Haveman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. I think all of you are anxious to get House staff back to this table, so I'll quickly offer just one observation with a couple of accompanying recommendations. The observation is this, that the passage of federal reform now makes state corporate individual income tax policies much more economically relevant and competitively relevant. Regardless of the degree to which one thinks state tax policy affects competitiveness generally, or residency, expansion, or siting decisions specifically, state individual and corporate income tax differentials are now accentuated because of the federal business individual relief that's provided. And how other states respond to this federal reform may also increase the relevancy of state tax policies even further. So as you tackle this rather complex task of conformity, I think the comment that was made earlier that a sort of Hippocratic oath approach to this is a very good one to take, that is first, do no harm. And a couple of recommendations I would offer for your consideration towards that end. First of all, manage conformity to achieve revenue neutrality. And the simplest way to do that would be is to reduce rates in accordance with the base broadening that will be taking place from conformity actions. For example, the State Tax Research Institute has created a preliminary estimate that Minnesota's corporate income tax base would increase by 12% as a result of federal conformity. That translates into a little over a 10% reduction in the state corporate income tax under a revenue-neutral situation or a state corporate income tax rate of about 8.75%. A second recommendation is to decouple from the 20% pass-through provision. There are a host of tax policy reasons that are violated with respect to this particular provision. Many problems with this, but from a simple tax policy perspective, it just also makes any tax rate adjustments in response to base broadening that much more difficult. Thirdly, be careful not to cherry-pick revenue-raising conformity features. As was discussed last week, there are many reform features that were designed to work in tandem with each other. For example, limitations on net interest deductions and the expensing of business investments, they sort of go together. Choosing one but not the other not only would undermine the policy intent of the reform, but could put the state at a bigger tax disadvantage as a result, a comparative disadvantage as a result. And finally, I would encourage you to seriously explore switching back to a federal adjusted gross income basis for income taxation. I think there are a number of good reasons to do this, not the least of which it offers the ability for Minnesota to sort of tailor the package of deductions and credits in a way that makes sense for the state. But perhaps one of the biggest reasons is down the road when the TCGA phase-outs are likely to occur, and they have the whole issue of whether or not they will be continued, you have that uncertainty of federal action colliding head-on with state economic forecasting and budgeting, which could really wreak havoc with state budget preparation. We have enough challenges with respect to economic forecasting as it is, and we don't need to introduce another big one into the equation as well. So, Mr. Chairman, some thoughts. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Questions for members? No, just wait. I have one question. You say Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. Do you have a copyright or trademark on that name?
Yes, we do.
Because I always thought that was the tax committee in the House. So, okay. Thank you, sir. Okay, we will now bring forward Mr. Michaels, Mr. Williams, and Ms. Templin or Ms. Schill. Is she here? Oh, okay. Okay, let's go with Mr. Michael, Mr. Williams, and Ms. Templin. Yeah, why don't we do that? Then. Okay, members, we are going to start over. I had a list from so much for the list, huh? We will just start in. Any opening remarks from Mr. Michael or Williams or Ms. Templin or Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, I think I've said more than enough already.
I'm still trying to figure a way around that thing for Mr. George. Okay, questions for members. Chair Markworth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And one of the big things that's been brought up is there is one-time funding in this conformity, and I think we want to make sure that we can identify the one-time funding. So if we're using that, we're only using it for one-time type investment. So I don't know if it's Ms. Templin or who, but when I look at kind of the spreadsheet or the revenue notes, could we identify exactly what is the one-time funding? At some point, we don't have to today necessarily, but it'd be great to have the items we know are one time, so we have kind of an aggregate amount of what we're working with one time.
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal. On the one-time funding, I think in the actual law, I think the repatriation revenue is the actual one-time funding because it's supposed to be spread over 8 years. And that's it. There's also talk, well, and if you have the spreadsheet, it is on page 5 under item number 10 under international business income provisions. The deemed repatriation of certain deferred foreign income in 18 and 19, it shows a revenue gain of $172.8 million. That is the one-time funding. There's also discussion about the FIDI and the GILTI revenue, which is just below the repatriation income. I don't think technically that is one-time income. I think that is our one-time revenue. That is, I think that there's more uncertainty with that revenue, but it's not technically one-time.
Excuse me, Ms. Temple, what did you say? As far as, okay, we've got the one-time with the repatriation, you said something under that?
Yes, the revenue are the items right below it, the two provisions, the inclusion of a global intangible low tax income, that's the GILTI revenue, and then just below that again, the inclusion of foreign derived intangible income, that is the FIDI revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And those sources of revenue are not technically one time, but I think the revenue is just in reading, the literature is more uncertain.
Mr. Michael, at that point?
Let me add a codicil to what Ms. Templin just said with regard to FITI. And this, I think, is important because when you look at that provision, which is essentially a deduction for certain foreign income of domestic corporations, one would normally expect when you provide a new deduction, one would expect that your income would go down, right? But if you look at the revenue estimate, it actually shows income going up. There's sort of a mystery involved here that is somehow buried in, and these numbers that revenue is using are from the federal revenue estimates. And built into those by the congressional economists are various assumptions about changes in behavior in response to things. This provision, the federal government estimates over 10 years, will reduce federal revenue by $64 billion. But there's a weird pattern to it as a result of these assumptions that the congressional economists use that we have no real information on how that is. They show for federal fiscal year 2019 through federal fiscal year 2022 that this provision will actually increase federal revenues. And that's what's showing up on the department's revenue estimate. So what happens is that this provision will actually over time reverse and cause, if you conform to it, will cause Minnesota in the long run to lose revenue. So Ms. Templin is correct that this is not a one-time provision, but what's unusual about it is that it shows up in the revenue estimate as a gainer, but over the long run it's actually a loser. So in some ways this is worse than a one-time revenue provision. So just be aware when you're making your budget decisions about that peculiar dynamic with this provision.
Mr. Michael, what's the long run? You mentioned in the long run it could be a loser. What's the long run?
The federal estimates show that I can't add these things up quickly, but in the short run it looks to me like it, in those first five federal fiscal years, it looks like to me that it raises a little less than $20 billion, but over 10 years on net, even when you net out that, it loses $64
billion. Okay.
And I think revenue, you know, on request, we'll show you what that is beyond the forecast budget window.
Chair Markworth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Michael, you were referring to both the GILTI and the FETI when you were talking about both of those. Is Ms. Templin both of those kind of line items?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Markworth, no. The GILTI provision is a revenue gainer long term.
Okay.
There are legal issues about how we can tax that and the reliability of the revenue and so forth, which is what Ms. Templin was mentioning. But the difference is that these provisions, these international provisions, there's a carrot and a stick. FITI is the carrot and GILTI. FITI is the carrot and GILTI is the stick. But the carrot in the short run looks like it's actually also a stick. It's not. I think what the congressional economists were doing was they were saying, with this change in the law, it's going to cause some behavioral change in the short run that's going to cause these companies to relocate income into as domestic income and generate a one-time revenue increase. But over the long run, it's just going to lose revenue.
I like carrots better than sticks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's good. We just, Mr. Chair, we just really need to watch out for that so we don't get caught in the long run. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Markworth. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael, is this based on a static or dynamic analysis?
Mr. Michael.
Numbers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, the federal estimates were done with dynamic estimating involved, but it's not. But it's done as a two-step process. And let me, I'm not an economist, but I'll try to sort of play one here. When economists talk about dynamic versus static that difference refers to what they regard as macro effects. So to what extent does do the federal changes have general economic overall macro effects on the U.S. economy? And those changes that they estimate, you know, there's sort of a wide range that have been done by a bunch of outside firms, but the congressional people, I think, came up with, I don't know, a $300 to $500 billion effect. That's a general effect that's just of the overall bill. It's not imputed to any individual provision because it's just the overall effect. However, when you're thinking static versus dynamic, these estimates do take into account sort of more what are considered to be microeconomic responses. How do people change their behavior because deductions and tax rates change? And so, yes, these estimates include behavioral changes that people, businesses respond to tax incentives. And so that's why I think is the explanation for this strange pattern for this, the FITI estimate, because the economists must be assuming that there's some fairly significant changes in behavior by these businesses that are affected by it.
Representative Grenhagen?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, the best explanation I heard of dynamic versus static, and, you know, in terms of tax cuts, people who oppose it generally say, well, use a static model, saying, well, if we cut taxes, we will bring in this much less revenue. A dynamic model relies more on your comments, where we actually change the behavior of businesses, they expand, grow, and you gain tax revenue. So, and I did read an economist, Art Laffer, you're probably familiar with the Laffer curve, and, you know, a static, here's the best definition of static versus dynamic that I heard. It's a static means you're precisely wrong, okay, in terms of tax cuts. A dynamic model means you're approximately right, okay? I'd rather be approximately right than precisely wrong. And that's the inherent problem with the analysis of some of these tax provisions, is that we don't take into consideration, to the degree I think necessary, the change of corporations and decisions, and look at the billions of dollars that have come back into this country, even since January 1st, by corporations to expand and relocate here.
Mr. Chairman, just to your definition of static versus dynamic sort of incorporates those sort of behavioral responses to individual provisions, which the congressional revenue estimators have always tried to take into account. It's this sort of macro response to the overall bill that is only more recently that they've taken into account. So there are two orders of behavioral responses that are involved. And the general conventional wisdom is that, the numbers that revenue is allocating are static revenue estimates, but they do still have embedded in them behavioral responses to tax changes.
Representative Grenhagen?
Let's move on. Okay. Okay. Other questions for staff on conformity? If not, their doors are open for members of the tax committee. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one more thing while we're talking about the foreign repatriation and things. You know, Minnesota has always kind of touted that we're unique because we have so many Fortune 500 companies, and many of them do a lot of international business. Are we disproportionately at risk or affected by these foreign tax or foreign earning provisions? And so we should really be much more careful because it'll have a longer-term impact on us than maybe some other states. It'd be nice to know if we get some data on, like, what percent of our revenue stream is affected by this, that sort of thing.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, that is a useful thing to think about. The way the repatriation tax will work, I think it might be helpful for you to understand a little bit about that, because it will reduce to a certain extent the amount of sort of that we do have a disproportionate amount of big multinational companies headquartered here for the size of Minnesota. But this tax, the corporate tax is an apportioned tax, and this income will be taxed as a dividend because that's what it is. It's a dividend that's paid by a company that's not part of the unitary group because our unitary group is limited to domestic corporations. So it's going to be paid by foreign-controlled corporations that are part of those multinationals. We have, for all of those, that kind of income, there's an 80% dividend deduction. So right off the bat, we're only going to tax 20% of it. So these numbers, these very large numbers that are subject, first of all, to an 80% discount. Then secondly, we apply our apportionment formula to that to determine then how much of that 20% is taxable to Minnesota. And recall that our apportionment formula is 100% sales formula. So when you're thinking about some of our big corporations like General Mills, for example, it's only the Cheerios they sell to Minnesota buyers that count in determining how much of that repatriated income will be taxable in Minnesota. So that's going to be another big discount. So it's not just so much how many of our Fortune 500, you know, this big number of multinationals that are that we're lucky to have headquartered in Minnesota, but it's how much of their sales actually are destinations in Minnesota that determine how much tax is owed. And revenue tries to take this all into account in apportioning these numbers. But you may want to ask them about that and what's the sensitivity, because this is a huge amount of money, mm-hmm. obviously. And so getting it right in both estimating and you all deciding how you're going to use that money is, you know, really a key thing in this whole discussion.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Michaels. You know, we've been talking for years about being part of a global economy, but I think right now, going forward, we're going to feel even more connected to it, and I appreciate your comment about the sensitivity in terms of having to understand what's happening in Minnesota versus what's happening in other markets as economic waves sometimes hit different shores differently. Thank you.
Very, very interesting question, very good question, because we do have a lot of Fortune 500 companies in Minnesota, whereas some other states would have fewer. So it's going to affect us a bit differently. But how about an Apple or a Microsoft not headquartered in Minnesota but sales in Minnesota? Do they do the same thing then? How much is sold in Minnesota? So be this. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. that's Mike. Correct. And I think that the biggest payer of this tax, I mean, I'd be willing to wager, you know, a substantial amount of money on that, is going to be Apple Corporation, because they have by far the largest amount of deferred foreign earnings. And I'm guessing that Minnesotans buy as many Apple products on average as everybody else.
Right there, the Davids Corporation.
Yeah. I forgot.
We'll have to do a little research here. Thank you, Representative Loft, a very good question. Any other questions? Otherwise, thank you very much, and the staff is available. They're going to be doing a lot of work. Tomorrow's agenda, the first bill heard will be a DFL bill, Sundin 2870. Then we have 2282, Richard Keel, and then Pearson 2099, Backer 2421, Knobloch 2811. And then we have a full agenda also for Thursday. Exciting times we live in. With that, if there's nothing else for the good of the order, good government all the time, we are adjourned.